And we're going to look at a passage in Mark chapter 9. So if you've got a Bible, keep it open. Open it, find one, access it through the web or whatever way it is that you find one. And I'm going to read one short passage, about 10 verses for you to think about this morning and a little bit later when you get home. I think this is where Jesus speaks to us very clearly about what service is and challenges us. So Mark chapter 9 and verses 35, sorry, chapter 10, my mistake, chapter 10, verses 35 to 45. I'll read it for us now. From verse 35. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. What do you want me to do for you? He asked. They replied, let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in glory, in your glory. You don't know what you're asking, Jesus said. Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? We can, they answered. Jesus said to them, you will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they've been prepared. When the 10 heard about this, they became indignant. They were very angry. They were very angry with James and John. Jesus called them together and said, you know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority of them, over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. It's a great passage, and it's probably the cheekiest question in the Gospels. I think it's absolutely outrageous. I think it's Matthew tells us that James and John went with their mum to Jesus, as if that makes it a bit better. Like, you know, it was mum's question, really, it wasn't ours. But there's James and John coming up to Jesus with this really cheeky question. And notice how they phrase it in verse 35. Teacher, you know, they could have called him lots of things, I suppose. They use the word rabbi, teacher. It's a term of respect. But they know a lot about him, don't they? I know a lot about Jesus that you can see on the pages. If you flick back a page or scroll down a page, you can see that incredible things have happened. At the beginning of chapter 9, there was the transfiguration. Jesus was revealed to Peter, James and John. They saw that he was something else, somebody different. Okay? They've heard Peter earlier on, Mark chapter 8 verse 27, confess who Jesus really is. He's not just a prophet. He's not just a nice man, he's the Christ. They've heard all of this. They know quite a lot about Jesus. I guess if you're in church this morning, you know quite a lot about Jesus. We could do a little quiz or a game, couldn't we, to find out how much you know. They know a lot. They've been living with him. They've had fish with him. They've been for barbecues with him. They've crossed seas with him. They've walked into towns with him. They've seen people healed. They've had complicated discussions with religious people. They've been told what it means to be a follower of Jesus. And yet here they are again asking this question, this really cheeky question. You see, if we have the first picture, Neil, we're going to do this old school, aren't we? The first picture, what you ask for shows what you're like. James and John's question, you'll see it in a minute. James and John ask this incredible question. And notice how they load it for Jesus, don't they? We want you to do for us whatever we ask. You're getting the concession from them already. Because if he says, yeah, okay, all right then, I'll do it then, they know they'll get what they want. And notice as well how cheeky this question is going to be. But look at what Jesus says in verse 36. He's unruffled by this attempt to kind of manipulate him. And so he says, what do you want me to do for you then? He's very approachable to these two guys. let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in glory. What are they asking? They are asking for the ultimate status. They want access to the throne room of heaven. They know who Jesus is. They've seen him. They've lived with him. Have understood this. And they really, really, really want in. They want in so much that they want the very best they can get, which is to be in heaven at Jesus' right and left hand. Because they know that's where he's going to be. Because they know he's a king. And so they want to sit with him on those plush thrones or whatever it is that you get that they think that you're going to get. They want to be right there with him. Probably dispensing kind of authority here and there, telling people to go and come and do whatever you like. Okay, they really want to be close. I guess also hidden in there is that they want to know they've made it. They really want to be secure. They really want to be absolutely sure. You know, life's hard. Life was really hard in Galilee. Life was really hard for fishermen. It was so hard, your hands hurt. It was that hard. And they really want to be with the Master. They want to guarantee that we're going to be there, please. Can you guarantee that now? I want my ticket. I want to see it. I want to know that I can walk into the stadium and sit down on that seat and watch that great spectacle that is not the Olympic Games, but is God reigning the universe. And I want to be there. I want to be right next to you. Best seat in the house. Can I have that, please? What a question. But it does reveal their heart, doesn't it? It shows their hearts. Just like what we pray for, what we ask. This is a prayer, really, isn't it? It's a question asked of Jesus. We do that, I hope. We do that quite a lot. When you ask a question of Jesus, what are you asking him for? Are you asking him for status, for recognition? Jesus, these people won't listen to me. They won't do what I want. Will you sort them out, please? Maybe we're asking him in the way that we approach a lot of things in life. What actually do I get out of this? What's the point in this? What's the point in this promotion that I'm going to get at work? What do I get out of it? Do I get my company car now? Maybe you're thinking about buying a new phone. What do I get out of this new phone? What kind of deal is in my contract? What do I get? I want to know that I get a better deal than the last deal that I got. What do I get out of this, Jesus? Maybe you're thinking about a new class teacher at school. Maybe with this new class teacher, this new course that you're studying at school this year, you've started your A-level course. And you're thinking, what am I going to get out of this? What's in it for me? When I finish it, will I be better off than I am now? When I get this qualification? That's behind what they're asking, isn't it? They're asking, I want to know that I'll be better off, Jesus, with you, because I'm going to get the very best that I possibly can get. I want some security. I want some guarantee. I want to be absolutely sure. You can phrase it another way, actually, and say this is the ultimate Facebook request, isn't it? The ultimate Twitter tweet, really. Facebook status. For those of you who do Facebook, if you don't tune out at this moment and tune back in a minute, if you do Facebook, Facebook's all about people recognising you for who you are and what you like and thinking, well, that's fantastic, I really like what you've done. You know, lol, brilliant, you're amazing, you've just said, done, seen something crazy, funny and photographed it and put it on Facebook. Yes, you've just gone up in my estimation, you are that much better. This is like the ultimate Facebook request to Jesus, isn't it? Jesus, we want you to approve us, to rubber stamp us, to like us, to put us in the top spot. And yet it does show our heart, doesn't it? And so the next picture, these famous praying hands, Dürer's praying hands, beautiful praying hands. People look at that picture for a long time, actually, and study the hands, those hands lifted in earnest prayer, actually. So let me ask you this morning, what are you praying for? Where is Jesus revealing where your heart is? Where is your security? Listening to people's prayers reveals where their hearts are, actually. And when we pray for the suffering church, well, actually, that moves our hearts to some degree. And if our prayers are full of the suffering church, well, that will be because our heart cares for the suffering church, won't it? But if our prayers are words of grasping for this or that or the other, or status or recognition or affirmation, that shows something of our heart. And Jesus may well be saying to you this morning, I want to do a deeper work with your heart, not with the words of your prayers, but with the heart that your prayers are coming from. And maybe he wants to challenge your security this morning. So you think less about your status with him, more about your security with him. And so how does he deal with James and John? Let's look back at the passage. Verse 38. So when I was reading this, I was thinking, how do you read this verse out aloud? You know, do you read it out in the sort of the voice of the sort of Roman centurion commanding his troops? You don't know what you are asking, Jesus said. Do you read it in some solemn voice? Is it a throwaway comment? You don't know what you're asking, lads. You just don't know. How does he say that to them? Because he knows what they're asking. He knows exactly, and he's going to reveal it to them, exactly what they're asking. So he unpicks them, doesn't he? And he calls us to true service. It's the third picture. What he calls them to, and us to, is actually our true place. Look what he says. You don't know what you're asking. This is what you're asking, Jesus said. Can you drink the cup I drink? Or be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with? What does this mean? Can you drink the cup I drink? It doesn't mean literally, you know, here it is, I'll pass it round, boys, have a swig. It doesn't mean that. The cup is the cup of God's wrath quite often. The cup is what it cost Jesus to serve God and follow God and live wholeheartedly for God and not for himself. Can you drink of that? Or actually, will you pass on that? So you have a bit. I'm good for now. I don't really need that. Thank you. Next person, please. Take a little bit of that. Have a sip. Can you handle that? The life of serving God. And then the image of baptism. We've seen it because it's happened in this building, hasn't it, since it's been rebuilt, right there, underneath where you're sitting. People who've said, actually, I'm going to be so fully immersed and sunk into God that it's going to be that as though I die for myself and I live for God and not for me anymore. Actually, my true place with God is to accept God's will and to say no to myself and yes to him and die to myself. That's where he asks me to be. You see, we want to be right up there, don't we? We want to be up there with God in the shiny place, in the place of glory. That's what they ask. Glory, we want to be in your glory, Jesus. Where he was, of course. But actually, we belong down on earth. We belong in the place where Jesus ends up. He ends up in a garden, doesn't he? Where does he talk about a cup? He ends up in a garden, kneeling, weeping, crying for the sins of the world that he's going to carry on his shoulders, that he's going to deal with. Let this cup be taken from me, if it's your will, God, but actually I'll do your will. Think of somebody else in a garden being offered something that they shouldn't have eaten, but they ate from. See, we at this moment, Jesus is reminding us, do you know where you should be? You should be on your knees saying, God, your will be done, not my will. Of course, Adam and Eve said, my will be done, not thy will, God. Jesus in the garden says, thy will, not my will. Okay? Can you do that? Jesus says, can you do that? Can you realize that we belong in service with God, not up there, not keeping up with the Joneses? Jesus knows what he's asking of us. He knows exactly what that is. Verse 39, they answer so quickly. Do they think about that? Again, I want to be there to record the moment on video and play it back. We can. Yeah, we can do that. Yeah, sure. Yeah, we're in it. We're in it for life, Jesus. We can take that. We can handle that. We can take anything you throw at me, I can handle. I'm not sure they're thinking it through. But the evidence of the gospel suggests the disciples aren't thinking it through. So he'll teach them, won't he? I had these words as well. They must have been painful words, but I imagine he looked at them deeply into the eye. I don't know. It doesn't say that. But how did he say this? Jesus said to them, you will drink the cup I drink. Oh, boys, I know how it's going to go for you. I know what it's going to cost you. And of course, he knows what it costs us as well. And of course, he knows what it costs the suffering church. And Ahmed, or whatever his name is, Jesus knows what it costs him to follow him. Of course he does. He wouldn't be the Son of Man, the Son of God. Otherwise, would he? You will drink the cup I drink, and you will be baptized to the baptism. And I know you're going to stick it out, actually, boys. I hope he can say that of you and me today. I know you'll stick it out. It'll be hard. It's never easy. It'll be much easier not to bother. But actually, I know you'll stick it out. That's, I hope, a great encouragement, actually. But then listen, he says, but to sit on my right or my left, that's not even for me to give. I've let the Father give that place. It's not up to me who sits at my right and my left. I can't give you that, boys. These places belong to those for whom they've been prepared. God has already got that prepared. Implication of this is there is a place up there and there will be some people up there, and it won't be James and John. Well, it might be James and John, but if it is James and John, it wasn't Jesus' call, it was the Father's call. That's been sorted out. You don't need to worry about that. That's not the important thing. Okay? You will serve me lifelong. At this point, I want to stop for a minute and ask us how we think of service and how we learn to accept service. You see, all of this question of service begins by accepting what Jesus has done for us. It's a very difficult thing to accept help quite often, unless you know you really need it. So if your car broke down in the rain outside, you'd probably be disposed to accept somebody's help. And yet if you're a man and it's raining outside and your car's broken down, you'll probably carry on getting soaked until you absolutely admit that you really can't start the car. Then you'll accept help, won't you? When it's been proven that you've tried everything, you've done everything you can, you've got your hands really dirty, you've wrapped your knuckles, my cars always break down in the winter, so you've wrapped your knuckles, your hands are cold and bleeding, and now you'll say, okay, I give up, and you phone somebody and say, can you come and give me a tow or a hand? And you could have asked for that sooner, couldn't you? But Jesus knows what he's asking of us because that's what he's doing for us. Accepting help, learning to serve begins with us learning to accept his help, first of all. When we realise where we really belong. Think of that verse, it's one that came to mind straight away. Think of that verse in Philippians chapter 2. He was up in glory, wasn't he? He was up there in the throne room, and yet he humbled himself. What does it say in Philippians chapter 2, verse 7? He took on the nature of a servant. He took on human flesh. He made himself nothing. He was everything. He became nothing. Why did he do that? Because we really need service. It's more serious than our car breaking down on the hard shoulder of the M40 or the M42. It's our entire life going in the wrong direction. Once we accept him serving us at the cross, then we are ready to serve others. And so the next picture shows us something that we know it's another story about service. I could have preached from this other passage. I thought this one would link there anyway. There's a picture of somebody's feet being washed. So he does that, doesn't he? He washes their feet. Not so much further on in the story, he's washing their feet. And of course, without preaching too much from that passage, you can read it for yourself at home. What he does is something they can't cope with. The disciples won't accept. Peter says, no, you can't wash my feet. Who washes feet? In a Jewish house, who washes your feet? Not a Jew. Somebody who's not a Jew. Someone who's been bought in, who's a foreigner, who's the lowest servant, washes your feet. You don't have a Jew washing feet for Jews. Oh no, feet are filthy. They've been in camel dung and dust and grit and all sorts of other squash stuff that you don't want to think about. Feet smell, they're horrible. And yet Jesus says, unless I do this for you, to Peter, unless you let me get this close to you and deal with what you really need, then there's no hope for you. And so Peter has to let his feet be washed. A very intimate thing to do. Could have done it here, but maybe you feel moved to suggest that we do that at some point. But just think for a minute. I mean, maybe that's happened to you. My wife occasionally has massaged my feet because I've got terrible problems with my feet. And it's very, very kind of her to do that. My feet do smell. And I really do appreciate it. They always feel better afterwards. They really do. That's true, Ellie, isn't it? You have to be pretty close and pretty loving to want to touch somebody's feet, don't you? Okay? And so to have your feet washed by Jesus, what a complete role reversal. And yet in that moment, Jesus is turning the world absolutely upside down and proving the King of Glory came so low. What does he wear when he does that, if you know the story? Jesus takes off his outer garment. He takes off his nice clothes, wouldn't have been that nice by our states and finery, and he is dressed then as a servant. And at that moment, he washes feet like a servant. Now, if you've let Jesus get that close to you and you've accepted that, somewhere your heart has changed. You're no longer thinking about your status because you know where you belong. You belong as the one whose feet have been washed by the Lord of glory. And then you think about serving the other person and putting the other person first because you've learned to receive, so now you can give. But just a few moments while we're on that slide with those questions, actually, just to think about service, how we practically serve somebody else. Just think about the picture of foot washing, if you like. Very gently, very carefully, with warm water and some soap and a towel. Get everything ready, don't you? Otherwise, wouldn't be very nice to wash someone's feet in cold water and then not be able to dry them because then their foot would go straight down on the carpet and they'd think, ow, that was kind of nice for a minute, but then it wasn't anymore. So actually, if you're going to serve somebody, you're really thinking about the other person first. To the degree that you thought it through and you've prepared yourself, and to this degree as well, actually, that you're prepared to accept that the other person doesn't want that help. Doesn't need that help. It's one of the hardest things I've had to learn, I think, in Christian ministry, actually, doing it for about 8 or 9 years full time. Sometimes people just don't want help. You can see they really need help, but they don't want help. And you can't help somebody who doesn't want help, can you? Just like you can't tell the gospel to somebody who won't listen, because you can't. You can't share the good news about Jesus and the cross if they just won't listen to that story. Now, part of loving someone is letting them walk away in pain, and that's hard. And then hoping, waiting, praying that they might recognise a bit later that actually that help they really could do with now, and actually you're in the right place to give them that help. So thinking about practical service in church as a community of believers, it's on that level sometimes for us, isn't it, actually? Being ready to serve someone, but accepting maybe they don't need that help, or maybe it's not for right now. So the question there is, do you accept service? Will you let someone help you or not? Say yes if you would, and say no if you don't. Sometimes that gets incredibly complicated, doesn't it, for us? But it needs to be as simple as, actually, that will be really helpful, thank you very much, or not. I'm going to read to you a beautiful piece of history from a village called Charlesfield in Suffolk. This is how things were back in the 1930s in Suffolk, in this small village where nobody really went anywhere or did very much. This is somebody, he's a blacksmith. He's remembering what it was like in the 1930s. He's called Gregory Gladwell. He was 44 when he was interviewed. And he said, 1930s were really, really high. In 1930, we had blackbird pie for Christmas dinner. And we had to catch the blackbirds, but we had the pie. That's how poor they were then, okay? And then he goes on to say this. The biggest change I've seen in Charlesfield is the growth of discontent. Greed. Nobody ever said, push off you, Jack. My head is out, when I was a boy. When you wanted help, it was given. It was, thank you very much, and that was that. You mustn't pay. It's good enough for a row if you offered to pay. Payment was a crime. This was how things were. In that small village, in the Depression in the 1930s, if you needed help, people gave help. And what did you say? Thank you very much. You didn't offer to pay. You said, there would be a row if you offered to pay. I just offered to help you, that's all. Just accept help. And yet, how hard it is for us today. I really think it's incredibly difficult, and becoming more so, for us to accept help. And to admit where we might need help, because we're all so independent. And the whole school system is set up to make you think, if you do these qualifications and get these things, then you'll be okay, you'll be able to sort yourself out. And yet, actually, if you're a Christian, Jesus is revealing your vulnerability, your weakness, your helplessness, and your need to serve others and to accept service. And that's very difficult for us today. And yet, I know I see examples all around that sort of thing happening. Can I have the fifth picture, please, Neil? So look, this is how Jesus sums up and teaches it. The 10 disciples come running over, ready to start a big religious row over what's been said and done, and how cross they get with James and John now. And yet Jesus explains it all like this. He calls them all together and sorts it all out. It's great when Jesus sorts it out, isn't it? He calls them all together and says, look,
This is how it is, verse 42.
You know
that those who are regarded as the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. And then he reminds them what he's already taught them. Mark's got this twice within a chapter. Clearly, we've got to learn this. And then, barely verses earlier, he's challenged them again about their attitude to become childlike in their hearts. And then he teaches them about whether they want to be great and what it means to be a servant or a slave. So, the picture, it's a mosaic of some Roman slaves doing what they do best, serving. And I love this picture because in the corner there, if you look, in the middle there, sorry, the man there is carrying a tray with, I like to think, some hotcakes or possibly some hot bread, which is brilliant because that's what Jesus did. You can think about that for a while. It's a really powerful image of Jesus actually carrying us. He is the bread of life, feeding us, isn't he? You see, Jesus does what we should now do. He is the Son servant. Look at verse 40 if you're verse 45. Not even the Son of Man. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. He's the Son who is the servant. And that is what he expects of us. What he has now done, he has gone that way so that we can now follow. That's the way of the cross. That's the way of the Christian who is Christing with their life, who is following him. Just let me pause for a minute and ask you this question. It's a great one. People often think about this. What car would Jesus drive? In America, they got very hung up with this a couple of years ago. What car would Jesus drive? Just think for a minute and I'll explain where I'm going with this. What car would he drive? Some of you would be able to tell me the name, brand and make and engine size, wouldn't you? Now, you think about it for a bit and you think, actually, he probably needed a 4x4, wouldn't he? Because he'd go off-road in Galilee. So he needs to go up a hill and down a hill and down the other side. He needs to be able to deal with water and all that kind of thing. So he probably needs a 4x4. Probably got quite a big 4x4. Okay, but he's not going to buy the latest one. Although he might be persuaded by the latest offerings from Jaguar and Land Rover, might he? Although I hear the latest ones aren't as good as the old ones, but there we go. I literally walked through a farmyard a few days ago with a man who works for JLR, and we had to stop as we walked through the farmyard. Why did we stop? Not because of the beautiful calves. No, not because of the pregnant cows about to give birth. No, not because of the architecture of the building. We had to stop because there was a Mark 1 tucked in the corner behind an old baler. We had to stop and look at that. Mark 1's a Land Rover, sorry, if you don't follow that. Would he drive a 4x4? Would he be off-road? I don't think he would, you see. Now, some of you might have said, actually, James, I've got it. He'd need a limo. Because I've been listening to your sermon so far and I didn't fall asleep earlier. He would need a limo because a limo would get the 12 disciples in. He'd have a really big stretch limo. If it was a 4x4 limo, that wouldn't work, would it? But it's just a limo anyway. And of course, there'd be a bath in it and then he could wash people's feet. Brilliant. Immediately, you prove that your heart's in the wrong place and you're thinking of the wrong kind of Jesus. Okay? And then you might say, no, you see, Jesus would drive. And this is what the American preachers and leaders worked out in the end. Jesus would drive some kind of eco wagon small thing, wouldn't he? He'd drive a really, really small car. And there is a picture, I haven't got it, but there is a picture of some American church leader getting out of some small car that he would never normally drive. Just to say, well, this is the kind of car that we think Jesus would drive. So American Christians need to drive this kind of car now. Still have a car, have to drive this kind of car now. Okay? Because that's where he'd be, of course. I have a problem with that, because in an eco wagon, you can't get a lot of people in it. And he wants to be with people. So do you know, I think you're wrong, actually. It's the wrong question. What kind of car would Jesus drive? I may have said this before. It's a big point for me. I think he'd be on the bus. Because he'd talk to people on the bus. He'd mix and mingle with people, even though the bus is, and we've just, Celia and I have discussed it, the bus is the most expensive way to go to Leamington. It's cheaper to go in the car. But he would go in the bus because he would talk and mix and mingle with people, and you could get a crowd of disciples on a bus and off a bus again. Great, I'm not sure how he'd wash feet, but you get on the bus, wouldn't you? You see, Jesus' status isn't tied up with his car, although ours is, isn't it? Jesus' status is tied up with the people he's come to serve. He's revealed his heart. And he's had to teach them that. Look, verse 45. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. Which is why he used this word, slavery. Because the slavery is the lowest of the low. You have no status when you're a slave. You are owned by somebody else. You belong to them. like the people in the picture, they belong to somebody else. Actually, their security is in the ownership of the family they belong to. We have to think for a minute about what slavery was like at that time. They weren't wearing shackles. Okay, we have to put aside the pictures that we often have of the terrible oppression, okay, that went on with Negro slaves and the slave trading and all those ships. That was so much worse. A Roman slave actually had a measure of security because the family would give them a roof, would give them food, and give them a job and a responsibility. They owed everything to that family. They had their status within that family. But they belonged and they did everything, and the master of the house could direct them exactly where they needed to go. This word slave is a very strong word, and it's going to jar with the hearers, with those disciples who hear it for the first time. I wonder if we have any sense of how much that jars with them and how much that should shake our worldview to think, actually, if he comes like that, who am I to impose on people who I think I am? And the last picture, if you've missed the entire sermon, you can wake up and watch this now. It's the most important part of the whole sermon. The last picture, it's great, this old technology. Here it comes. Can you see what it is? So it is the key verse, really. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. You see, the cross helps you and me understand service. The cross is where Jesus came. It's what he came for. It's who he came to be. It's who he is now, the one who's been on the cross, but the cross could not hold him. He's the one who was crowned on the cross, wasn't he, King of the Jews, and yet despised at that moment. He was at that moment most himself, and yet most despised. And yet he knew exactly who he was at that moment, exactly where he belonged. And because he went there and was absolutely sure of who he was and who he is, then we have security. That I started off by asking that question, where is your status? Where is your security? Where is it in your heart when you pray? Your security, actually, if you're a Christian here today, is in knowing what he did for you. Not in what you're going to get out of it. Not even in how well you're doing today. When we think about service, we can often think, oh, look, well, I did all those things. I must be getting better at it. Actually, it doesn't work that way. Your security is in your belonging with Jesus, in the satisfaction of knowing Jesus and what he's done for you. That you belong. He served you. So you can serve others with the love that he has for you. And the whole of your life is probably spent considering that cross and thinking, I've yet more to learn from my Christ who went to the cross for me so I didn't have to go there. Because he served me, I can serve you, brother or sister, in the words of that song. He was, words of another hymn, an old hymn I used to sing at school, humbled for a season, wasn't he, to receive a name from the lips of sinners unto whom he came. He came to us and we've named him Christ, and kept him, and crowned him. So we need to take our little crowns off and put them down and learn to serve from the heart in the way that he did and the way he still does when we call on him. This passage of scripture started, I said, with a prayer from James and John. I'm just going to be quiet for a moment. We thought a lot about service. I'm just going to invite you to reflect on that. Perhaps you want to reflect through on some of the questions that were there. What are the kinds of things that you're asking him for?